Learning from the Rackspace Security Breach with Troy Vinson.
The Azure DevOps Podcast is a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Each show brings you hard-hitting interviews with industry experts, innovating better methods, and sharing success stories. Listen on to learn how to increase quality, ship quickly, and operate well. And now your host, Jeffrey Palermo.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jeffrey Palermo, your host for helping you and your teams establish quality and achieve stability and to increase speed using Azure and, well, using everything that the .NET ecosystem has to offer. The podcast is sponsored by ClearMeasure, a software architecture company empowering .NET teams to be self-sufficient and world-class. And any companies needing fractional software leadership, go ahead and give ClearMeasure a call. They help in-house software teams to be truly world-class. So they've been a great sponsor for the show. If you have a comment or question for the show, just send me an email at podcast@palermo.network. And the new video show is now 6 months old, so it's not so new anymore. You can search for, quote, Programming with Palermo in any of the podcast directories or on YouTube. You can also find it on www.palermo.network. And that goes deep into individual topics, video and audio. I'm really having a lot of fun going through various software engineering topics on Programming with Palermo, so you can join me there. Our guest today on the show is a repeat guest, Troy Vinson. He was on guest 161, and we'll include a link to that show in the show notes. But Troy Vinson is a principal software architect at ClearMeasure, and he's also a CISSP, which stands for a Certified Information System Security Professional. He's an experienced leader, architect, and problem solver in information system security and software development technologies, and has spent the majority of his career integrating computer science, information science, and cognitive science to assist in software development and the management of information. Troy, welcome back to the show. How are you, sir?
I'm great. Thank you, Jeffrey, for welcoming me back.
Oh, my pleasure. And for, I can hear the listeners with a question mark above their head out there. Are you a certified ethical hacker, or what the heck is that? And what do all these security certifications mean?
Currently, I hold a CISSP, and I have held in the past a certified in data forensics and also as a certified ethical hacker with EC Council. I've kind of let those lapse as my job roles have shifted. But yes, that is in my past, is ethical hacking and penetration testing.
Okay. Now, I've talked to quite a few people who are systems engineers or programmers and leaning towards security. And there always seems to be a theme of kind of leaning towards a sysadmin type career and then focusing on security. But correct me if I'm wrong, you focused a whole lot on the actual code. You are a programmer. And you're focusing on security. How do you think about the divide and the focus?
Well, there's a lot of different domains in the security field. There's everything from regulation and compliance to network security to application security. Just you have IT communications. There's a lot of different domains. So there's really an area for just about anyone to step into the security field, depending on what their interests are. Myself, I started out as a programmer, been in the industry for a little over 25 years, and kind of grew up in those ranks. And as I became introduced into IT management and application development management, it became my responsibility to look after the security aspect of what we were building. And I kind of fell in love with that application security role and started learning from there.
Okay. Oh, awesome. Fantastic. Well, on the 12th of December of 2022, Rackspace's hosted email exchange kind of had some difficulties. And on their status page, since then, it's had some outage indicators. And I want to try to figure out as .NET development teams what we can learn from this and what we should do in our environments and what we can learn from it. But what do we know about the Rackspace security breach, if anything, at this point?
Yeah, we know very little. They've been very tight-lipped. Really, they've been saying that they want to not have to backtrack on any information that they release. So, and they've been very careful about not saying too much or too little so that they don't have to come back and correct themselves later. What we do know is that their hosted exchange services are unavailable. We have some anecdotal evidence, not anything directly said, but some anecdotal evidence that it was a ransomware attack that caused this to go down. So the information that is on their hosted exchange services is encrypted and they're not able to access it.
So it smells like a ransomware attack.
It smells like a ransomware attack. And I haven't read anything about Rackspace this afternoon, but that would be the most likely guess. And I think that's how most people are handling that right now.
Yeah. And I actually know personally some customers who are on there. Actually, the email of my hometown church, all of the staff had email on Rackspace Hosted Exchange. And seems like for those not using the additional archive backup service, those emails are just not available. How did the backup not be affected, but the regular hosted exchange become affected?
Well, the backup's done incrementally, so they can actually go back to a point in time on the backup and retrieve that information. Now, that is an optional service for Rackspace customers. So if you have the hosted exchange service, you can have the email archive service as well, but it's not included. So not everyone who was a hosted exchange customer has their data backed up on a separate service, mm-hmm. which is the email archive service. But those who did have the separate email archive service, I've heard that, and that is third party, that they are already retrieving some historical data from that.
Mm. Well, that's certainly good news for those customers. I think one number I saw was somewhere around 300,000 hosted exchange customers that Rackspace has. So that's a lot. Now, if we look at this issue, anybody who's been doing IT or any kind of hosting for a long time, Rackspace is a huge player. And I've certainly used plenty of Rackspace throughout my career, and it's because they've been such a big player. And now with so much being hosted on Azure and even lots of customers hosting things on AWS, Rackspace has had a great reputation for a long time. If this can happen at Rackspace, then the thought is, okay, well, shoot, it can happen to me. It can happen anywhere. Is that true, or is this just a special case?
No, it is true. Basically, this is, if in fact this is a ransomware problem, then ultimately it is a human problem. Mm. At somewhere along the way, a human was involved in allowing this to happen. So that's whether it was a phishing attack or someone on the inside, something like that. As long as humans are involved, then we're definitely going to have security issues. So it's important that we understand that and we take the steps to safeguard against any of those things happening. Can't do it 100%, but we can definitely kind of ratchet down on the security controls and help prevent that from happening.
Okay. So you would think that Rackspace has tons of security controls and still it happened there. So aside from knowing exactly what happened there, for all of the listeners out there who are running some software, let's just narrow it down, some software in one of the services in Azure, but they're running, you know, custom software. What controls do you consider to be just, you know, the basics, a ticket to the game? What should all of them be thinking about and doing?
I think the first thing that we need to look at, especially in this case, is backing up data is a very important thing to do. Back it up regularly. have a plan for it, have a recovery plan in place, and don't put it all in the same place and that that your data is already in. So make sure that you get it off system and back it up into another location. And a lot of the services offer geo redundancy and different forms of local redundancy of data. So there's ways to back that up, even in an Azure or AWS cloud, where it's not sitting on the same system. And I guess that's really, you know, one of those things too, is not putting your eggs in one basket. Have contingencies in place. It's important for business continuity. I feel for these companies that cannot access their email, cannot access the things that they need in order to continue with normal business operations. But you know, having something in place that allows for you to continue to operate is really important, and making sure that you have your information in different places and a recovery plan is big for that. I think also, and when you're looking at this, you need to look at access controls as well. Know who your users are, know what they can do, use privileged access management property, use that to limit the user access privileges to only the information that they need to do their job. And there's even a lot of when you look at Azure platform, the just-in-time privileges is a great way to do that, where you lock everybody down, and when they need to perform a function, then have that ability given to them for that period of time in order to complete that job function. It's yeah. That doesn't necessarily apply to everything that gets done, but certainly when you're talking about having access to change data, that's an important thing to look at.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Over my career, I guess 25 years or so, for myself, there's been customers that have given me credentials to systems with production data and whatnot, just in order to do the job, whether it was read-only to data or whether it was, otherwise. And I've had to go back after the fact and like, wait a minute, we stopped working together. This was a while ago. You still have me as having access, and maybe you can trust me, but what if something happens and that account somehow gets compromised or whatnot? It's like, well, shoot.
So yeah. Just the fact that you know that should tell you right off the bat that company does not have the policy and the procedure in place to deactivate accounts. Otherwise, it would have been done. Yeah. So yes, I've been in the same boat where I have access to someone's encryption keys, and go back a year later, and I still have access to encryption keys that are valid, and even those that have rotated to new keys. And it's like, please take me out of this. Please take my access away, because if something happens, of course, I don't want to be on one of those lists of people to look at when I didn't even know that I had the access anymore.
Right. Now, on that point, unfortunately, there's so many systems where when you're putting someone in a security group or when you're creating an account, it doesn't automatically have an expiration date. That's not, for some reason, that's not built in as a first class citizen in the first place, which, man, wouldn't that make it so much easier? But so what is the practical? Is there tools that if someone's asking, okay, I want to do that, how do I do it? Is it a scheduled ticket in the ticketing system? What's kind of the most just basic way that someone could start doing that for themselves?
Well, I mentioned Key Vault earlier, and I really like Key Vault. And one of the things that I've seen with that is that a lot of the software that is generating keys and managing keys They are moving away from the default of not having an expiration or a default of you know, allowing everyone access, to tightening that down and saying, as you look at Azure, you go in and generate a new key, then you will actually have a dropdown of, you know, it says, okay, it's a 30-day, 60-day, 1 year or mm-hmm. 2 years, and there's not even an option anymore
for a
non-expiring key.
Yeah.
And that used to be there, and that used to be the default, is to have a non-expiring key.
Yeah.
So, you know, you go and see that. So the industry has really moved towards getting those defaults in place and really encouraging people not to select or removing the ability to not have expirations. Those systems that do key management, those systems that do password management, they also are now coming with the ability to notify when it's time to do something, or even to do automatic key rotations through the CI/CD pipeline. Mm-hmm. And that's something that is really nice to see, because then you can have very short-lived keys, and then, but through continuous integration, have those keys rotate and not have expired keys on your system or expired passwords on your system.
Yeah.
Many thanks to our podcast sponsor, Clear Measure. Clear Measure is a software architecture company that empowers clients' development teams to be self-sufficient, moving fast, delivering quality, and running their systems with confidence. Whether starting a new project or developing new technologies or techniques, Clear Measure sets up your team to deliver world-class results. Learn more at www.clearmeasure.com. Clear Measure, empowering software delivery. Clear Measure is also happy to be a sponsor of the video podcast, Programming with Palermo. Watch, learn, and program alongside Chief Architect Jeffrey Palermo. Videos are added weekly and available on syndicated locations supporting video podcast or by visiting palermo.network. Tune in today.
You had mentioned not putting all your eggs in one basket and the unique attack of ransomware and for backups. For a long time, the normal backup tension was, if I lose this data, or even if a user accidentally changes a huge swath of it, I can go to my backup and I can restore that data and I'm back online. But first, like SQL Server, well, the backup database might be on the same SQL Server cluster, just a different place. Or it might, either way, if an account gets compromised, then everything that account has access to could be encrypted with this ransomware, which would include backups. Or if it's just even if it's a OneDrive account or a network share, even if you have backup folders, everything got encrypted, including the backup. So this is a new way of thinking from the multiple decades of backup logic, isn't it?
It is somewhat, but it falls in line with how we used to do offsite magnetic tape backups. You know, mm-hmm. So you always had that thing. So if your building burnt down, then you would still have old Iron Mountain to go to and retrieve your magnetic tapes. So it's
the principle is the same. Offsite, different rules for access.
And then, of course, you have to have your backup policy, that plan in place. You know, how do you do incremental versus differential backups? You know, are your deltas safe, from day to day, or is it hour to hour, depending on what your traffic is and the transactions that you have? Then that will guide how you need to develop your backup policy and plan.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. So you had mentioned earlier that with ransomware, it tends to be a human vulnerability or a people problem. Yeah. And so for people problems, that doesn't mean just developers either. That means anybody that's using a computer?
That means anyone, especially anyone who has access to a network and email. Yeah, so that is the thing, we have to have our security awareness programs so that every employee is aware of the things that can happen, that they become familiar with tactics that are used for phishing and different different types of attacks that they can have happen to them sometimes on a daily basis. They need to know to stop clicking on links that when you didn't request something from someone, don't click that link, you know, mm-hmm. or at least examine the link and, you know, determine whether or not it's safe to click and it's something that you were expecting. The same thing with software. You know, don't install untrusted software. As a company, have a policy in place for mitigating that, you know, not allowing people in certain roles or, you know, however you want to segregate that, but locking down the ability to install software that may affect the system. Mm-hmm. And see, that can even from the area of having someone who is, you know, maliciously trying to go in. Well, if you've locked down their ability to install software, well, now that malicious user has difficulty, you know, performing that task. So it's not just an unintentional use, but it's also a protection against a malicious use as well.
Yeah. On the non-malicious side, I just recently I experienced a new thing that I hadn't seen before. You know, around Christmas time, there's actually quite a few people that are receiving packages ordered in the mail. And it wasn't an email. It was a text message. And it was a multi-line text message. It says, from USPS, you know, U.S. Postal Service, we are having difficulty delivering your package. Please confirm your... And it had a link. And I looked at it. I'm like, this is... Because in my spidey sense, but I'm in software, right? To the normal person, they would have said, oh, I want my package. Tap. And now I in a protected session, I actually took that URL. I wanted to inspect it. So I pulled it up. And it's asking for like full details. It has a clone of the U.S. Postal Service website with navigation and all that stuff. I mean, really well done from a deceitful point of view. But I'm thinking, man, what do normal, non-technical people, do they have a chance?
Mm-hmm. Well, and it doesn't even have to be really deceitful either. Something very simple just happened to me very recently where I received a text message that said, Troy, are you available? And it was signed by my supervisor. it was his full name.
Oh, wow.
And you know, fortunately, I could look at that and see the phone number was not his phone number. But not everybody has their boss's phone number in their, you know, in their contacts. They should, yeah. But you know, it doesn't always happen that way. Or someone up the chain, right? Mm-hmm. So even a message that simple, and as a matter of fact, because it's simple, it looks like it could be. It could be legitimate,
yeah.
But you know, so then, you know, if you were to respond back to that text message, then you could be on the, you know, on the receiving end of some kind of scam that is trying to get you to send money or whatever. Yeah. And you already think that you're talking to an authority at that point. So yeah. These are things that people have to learn how to identify. Yeah. And you know, there's real good training out there for this. And not everyone comes at this with a head of knowledge to say, oh yeah, that
looks fishy.
that looks fishy.
Literally fishy.
Yeah, exactly. So,
all right, so you say there's training out there, and I can hear the listeners screaming, well, tell me what it is, because they're like, I don't know what's good training and what's not good training. So what do you like? What training providers or programs have you found to be good that you might recommend?
Well, and we are a user of Know Before, and that is an experienced company in providing high-quality security awareness training. So that's when they do that through posters you can put around your office, to video training modules, to role-based security training. So they have, and there's a lot of that now. Many of your like GRC providers that are providing software so that you can keep track of your compliance to security rules.
What does GRC stand for?
That's governance, regulation, and compliance.
Okay.
So if you find yourself in the healthcare industry and you're having to keep up with a HIPAA standards, you probably have a software suite that is helping you to meet that criteria of compliance. And almost all of them offer an additional module to go along with that, because most, if not all, regulations, all of the standards are requiring companies to have some sort of security awareness training.
Mm-hmm.
So, regardless of what industry you're in, most likely you have something that is that's saying that you should be training your users in preventing them from clicking on links that they're not supposed to, and understanding what data classification is, so that they understand what they can and cannot reveal, or how they must treat different types of data.
Mm-hmm.
So that's important training for people to receive, and not only to receive it once, but to receive it periodically, so that it stays ingrained in their mind.
Reminded. All right, we'll include the link to Know Before in the show notes. It's www.knowbe4.com. So yeah, that is a good one. So back to the development teams on the technical things that they should be thinking about. Is there a list of things that you would say, oh yeah, always be thinking about these items or doing certain items?
Yeah, depending on what kind of access you have and what kind of systems you're trying to back up or to protect. If you have your own hosted or you have your own email exchange service or any kind of email service, install the email protection that is available to you on your servers.
Like SMTP, if you're running your own email sender.
Right. If you're running that, or even if you were running a local exchange server, which some people are still doing that. But there are both email software for protection, and there's also email appliances that can be applied to a network to filter through emails and look for things like spam and things like phishing attacks. So, mm-hmm. So those get caught before they get to the user. It won't catch everything, but it'll definitely catch the ones that the definitions are out there that they mm-hmm. can look at.
Okay. And how about custom applications?
On custom applications?
Yeah, what should development teams be thinking about security-wise for their custom applications?
Always have some sort of, when you're developing something, both static and dynamic analysis to test your code, to test how the code is being used, and to really point out where there are deficiencies or problems that can be exploited. So, whether it's using something like SonarLint from SonarQube when you're developing code to actually having that implemented in your continuous integration as well, you can do that. But you also really need to have that dynamic testing in place, testing how things are being used, the fuzzing logic, doing penetration tests both in development and in production, so that you understand where your problems are before they get exploited.
Mm, that's a good point. We'll include the link to Sonar Lint in the show notes. So that runs, does that run on the environment before, after deployment? Where does that go?
So Sonar Lint, and there is a, there is a Visual Studio extension. There's an Eclipse extension for that. And it actually will test in a number of different languages, from C# to Java to Python, and be able to point out where there are issues. So yes, it does. It gets installed in the IDE. It could be run at command line, and it can also be run in your automated deployments as well.
Okay. Does it run on the source code, or does it run on the compiled assemblies?
Well, SolarLint itself is running on source code.
Okay.
It's a static code analysis.
So really, it'd be perfect in someone's continuous integration build process.
That's correct.
Nice. Okay. What other thoughts would you say are general recommendations for custom development teams?
Make sure that you keep all your software updated. Use the updated IDEs, but also we use a lot of third-party software now, and we don't really think of it as third-party software. But every time we include a NuGet package, we're using third-party software there.
Yeah,
and there are. It's important for us to understand what the vulnerabilities are in those pieces of software as well as ours, because as soon as that vulnerability is in place in that software, it's also in yours now. Mm-hmm. So, we really have to make sure that we are running it as intended, not in clever ways, and also that we're keeping it updated and we keep aware of those vulnerabilities that are in that.
That happened to NPM, what, about a year ago? A very common package that then was included by lots of other common packages. It's like almost anybody who did node development somewhere in the stack was using this package that got compromised.
Yep. NPM was a huge issue that happened with that, and it affected countless hundreds of thousands of people.
Yeah. Well, if you think about it, I mean, what common NuGet packages are used by tons of people? I mean, it could be the package that uses a custom Azure DevOps task or a custom GitHub action that you just declare and you're using, but those packages get loaded dynamically. And if the account that has access to publish to NuGet gets compromised, well, now that's going to end up being used.
So. And some of them we don't even see. So you look at something like Slow Cheetah, that's used for doing configuration file transforms. Mm-hmm. There, you can install that directly in your code, but you can also install it as an extension in your IDE in Visual Studio, right? Mm. So you never even see it there in your code, but it's being compiled in when you're creating it, when you're building it, it's still using it to do those transforms. And so you just really have to be aware, creating a software bill of materials, so that you understand what is in your software, that you have a policy about which software can be used, mm-hmm. and having some kind of change management in place so that people can say, well, I would like to use this. What is our evaluation criteria? Mm-hmm. How do we use this now that it's something that we need? And having a way of getting that through an approval pipeline and added to your known list of software, mm-hmm. so that you can keep track of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Good points. Well, as we kind of get to the end of our time here, if a development team lead is realizing, oh shoot, I don't have anything written down. I don't have any plan. Is there a place that you should say that they should start first?
Well, especially if you're going with Microsoft, you know, common Microsoft development, which we do a lot here, then I would say, you know, go ahead and Google that Microsoft Security Development Lifecycle. It's a lot of good information on the Microsoft site for the steps that are required in building secure software. From gathering requirements to, you know, understanding your attack surface and doing a threat analysis to, installing that static code analysis and dynamic code analysis software and, you know, having all these things, understanding what those steps are. I think that that is probably the biggest jump that needs to be made. Is understanding that there are best practices in place, and knowing what those are and how to implement them is important for a development manager to get a hold of, and not try to go around because it's you know it's hard, but you know definitely. You know, to use the cliche, you know, shift left and, you know, put that on, put a lot, as much of that up at the beginning of your project as possible to make sure that you're following those steps all the way through. And then when your feedback loop comes around, then those things are continuing to be informed as you continue developing.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. That's good. Well, thanks Troy for coming back on the Azure DevOps podcast and helping us to analyze what happened at Rackspace and what we can learn and how we should be thinking about security in our own software teams. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me back and had a great time.
My pleasure. My pleasure. And until next time, keep shipping.
You've been listening to the Azure DevOps Podcast, a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Go to www.azuredevops.show for show notes and other episodes. On behalf of your host, Jeffrey Palermo, and our sponsors, thanks for listening, and may God bless you.